Some of the biggest scientific minds on the planet converged on the city of Brisbane for the World Science Festival. And so we invited some of those great minds to be part of a storytelling night. It was called Under the Microscope. We got stories of genius and madness, black holes and divorce, and how one man, at the age of 14, mixed up illegal science with the Black Panther movement to his mother's everlasting horror. The first storyteller was Ian Fraser, former Australian of the Year and the key figure behind the invention of the vaccine against cervical cancer. Ian Fraser's story was about the decision that changed his life forever.
I was 15 years old in Aberdeen in Scotland, and I made a decision at school to study German. Not because I was particularly interested in studying German, but to get back at my parents. I had already made my mind up at that time that I wanted to be a scientist, an astrophysicist, as it happens, and I was studying science. But I had to make other choices about subjects to study, and one of the choices I had to make was between studying history and studying music. Now, I really wanted to study music, but my parents had other ideas. They were quite sure that my career would be much better if I took an academic subject like history. So I thought, I'm a rebellious teenager, how can I best rebel? So I dropped studying French, which I'd been studying for 2 years, and took up studying German. Because I was studying German, I had to acquire a German pen friend. That was expected. And the pen friend was Matthias, and he lived in Stuttgart, and his mother was the public relations expert for the Porsche car factory. And I wrote studiously to Matthias for a couple of years, and then I realized when I was about to go to university that I'd better get a job, because I needed some money. And jobs in Scotland for students were hard to come by. So I wrote in my best German that I was really looking for a job in Germany. 2 months later, I found myself working in the Porsche car factory in Zuffenhausen, testing the wheel bolts on Porsches to see if they were up to scratch. Just as a warning to any of you, if you're looking for a 1970s used Porsche, just be rather careful because the wheels just might fall off. But Matthias had a girlfriend called Doris, and she lived on the other side of town, and every weekend he and I would drive across so that he could spend some time with Doris. And of course I was about as welcome as a third hand on those visits, so I felt that I should go off and do something else. And I actually spent my time with Doris's father, Professor Guntert. He was a medic and he worked at the university, and I talked to him about how I wanted to do astrophysics, and he talked to me about medicine and said, look, you know, looking out at the stars, that's very nice, it's a good hobby, but if you really want to do something useful in life, look inward, look at yourself and study medicine. I'm obviously easily persuaded. So I decided when I went back to Scotland to study that instead of enrolling in physics at the university, as I had done, I would change to enroll in medicine. Physicists are not renowned for their social skills. I apologize to the physicists in the audience. I'm sure they'll recognize themselves. The medical crowd were much more sociable, and that gave me a chance to meet Caroline, who is now my wife. That, in turn, gave rise to 3 children. So you could say that those children were born because I chose to study German. But the point of this bit of the story is that I also had to make a decision about where I was going to go for an elective as part of my medical course, and I, after some thought, I decided that I would come to Australia. I can't think of what the reason for that was, except that perhaps it was the furthest place from Edinburgh and Scotland that I could possibly go. And indeed, I came out to Australia for 3 months and then went back to Scotland. And when I was making a decision about what I would do once I was qualified as a doctor, I decided I would very much like to go back to Australia to do some research. I applied to come out here, and they asked me about my criminal record, and I said I didn't realize you still had to have one to come here. But they let me in anyway. And I worked with Ian Mackay in Melbourne studying liver disease. And after a couple of years of studying liver disease, he suggested I should go off and see some of the world experts in that area, you know, to bring my skills up. And he offered me a choice of a professor in Paris or Herr Dr. Hans Beyer zum Buschenfelde in Heidelberg. And of course, I recognized that Herr Dr. Hans Beyer zum Buschenfelde would probably speak German. So I went off there and talked about liver disease with him. He was sort of interested. But he afterwards took me to meet with the director of the institute where he worked, Herr Dr. Professor Harald Surhausen. Now, some of you may know that name because Harald Surhausen was the 2008 winner of the Nobel Prize for Physiology and Medicine for his work connecting papillomavirus with cervical cancer. So when I went to talk with him, I talked a little bit about liver disease. He sort of brushed me off on that. Then he talked at me about papillomavirus and cervical cancer. And he spent quite a while telling me about the interesting stuff. And then he said, look, there's a really big question that we don't have an answer to. Here's a virus that infects humans that we just don't get rid of, and it causes cancer. And we don't understand anything about why we don't get rid of it. Well, I'm always looking out for opportunities, so I thought, right, okay, when I go back, I'm going to think about doing something with papillomavirus. I was getting rather fed up with liver by that time. Boiled liver is really not very nice stuff to work with. So I changed to studying papillomavirus, and in consequence of that, went off on sabbatical back to the UK to meet the then expert in the field of the body's defences against papillomavirus, Margaret Stanley, who worked in Cambridge. I wanted to work with her, but she had no money, so I sort of stole stuff from the lab next door. And that was very useful because going next door, I met this young Chinese doctor, Jan Zhu, who was also stealing stuff from the lab next door. Now, we had two things in common. We were both passionate about papillomaviruses, which was good. And the other thing was that neither of us spoke the common language that was spoken in the lab, which, of course, was English. I mean, Jan, he spoke Chinese. Me, I spoke Scottish. So we communicated by sign language and worked on papillomavirus. And the end result of that was that I invited Jan to come back with me to Australia to work on a vaccine against cervical cancer. And I guess you could say that the rest is history. Well, but just consider this. By that time and by now, basically, I've forgotten all that history I was supposed to learn back at school. And unfortunately, my German isn't quite what it used to be either. But I do ponder somewhat what might have happened if I had, instead of studying German, had stayed studying French. I think that it's quite likely that someone else would have come up with the cervical cancer vaccine. Scientists are good at solving problems. But as for me, well, I suspect I probably would have ended up as a broke, single astrophysicist working in France. Thank you very much for your attention.
Professor Ian Fraser, the man behind the human papillomavirus vaccine. The next storyteller was Julianne Struver. Julianne is a glaciologist, which means she studies polar ice. And for a while, Julianne was sent out to live in the snowy interior of Greenland.
I didn't always want to be a glaciologist. In fact, I wanted to be an astronaut. But that was until my parents took me to Disney World when I was 14, and I got into the Mars simulator. Did you know that it is the only ride at Disney World that comes with barf bags? They try to simulate the G-forces that you would experience during a rocket launch by spinning you around and around and around super fast. After that ride, I realized I wasn't going to be an astronaut. But I still had this really strong pull towards exploration and adventure. And I thought, well, if I can't go into outer space, perhaps I can travel to the far ends of the Earth. It was 1993 the first time I went to Greenland. I was 27 years old. And just getting to Greenland is an adventure in itself. From the U.S., you have to fly a U.S. Coast Guard C-130 airplane to get there. It's one of those huge gray planes with the four propellers that you see paratroopers jumping out of in the movies. There are no traditional seats. There's only jump seats. It is very loud, and it is not heated. So I have my earplugs in. I have on all the warm weather gear that I own. And it takes about 7 hours for us to get to Greenland from the east coast of the United States. So Greenland is the world's largest island, And it is completely covered by ice, or nearly completely covered by ice. But there's so much ice that at the summit of the ice sheet, it's about 3 kilometers thick. So if you can picture Greenland in your mind, we landed on the western middle part of the island in a little town called Ilulissat, which has about 3,000 people and 10,000 dogs. And all of these dogs are chained up outside. They are not pets. They are all working dogs. And when one of them starts barking, they all start barking. It's just like this 10,000 dog cacophony. When we arrived, it was May, and everything was frozen. Even all the little tiny fishing boats in the bay were all frozen in. When I got there, I took a walk to the Jakobshavn Glacier. This is one of the world's fastest discharge glaciers that moves about 20 meters of ice per day, produces about 10% of all of Greenland's icebergs. So I sat there, and I was absolutely mesmerized watching these massive icebergs calving off of the ice sheet and choking the fjord. It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. It was breathtaking. I sat there for quite some time, just contemplating the majesticness of it all. And when I got up to leave, I noticed that there were cigarette butts on the ground, and there was broken glass from beer bottles. And I realized that even in such a remote and pristine place as this, that there was still evidence of mankind. Getting to our campsite, we flew a tiny twin otter airplane from Ilulissat to about 1,000 meters up on the ice sheet. We were going to be there for 2 months, and there were 6 of us, myself and 5 guys. We landed safely on the ice sheet in what appeared to be this vast, featureless nothingness. There was nothing there. There were supposed to be 3 semi-permanent Quonset huts at the campsite, but they were completely buried under the snow. All we could see was just at the end of a tower sticking out of the snow. It was a little disconcerting when the plane just left us there. So we set about to dig, and we dug for hours and hours and hours just to get the first tent uncovered. Since the doors open up outwards instead of inwards, which would have been smarter, you had to dig all the way down to the bottom to get the tents open. So we got our first tent open, the cook tent, and we made something to eat, we got something hot to drink, and then we set about to digging out the other tents. I think it all took about 12 hours before we could get into our sleeping tent and also the work tent. Life at camp during those 2 months revolves a lot around mealtimes. It's the one thing you absolutely look forward to every day. And we would all rotate cooking duties, and surprisingly, everyone was a decent cook. The Swiss in particular were very good at making yummy sauces. We all slept in one tent, and this was a little bit problematic for me because the guys actually snored quite loudly. And they didn't smell that good. In fact, we all stank. It's a bit of an effort to try to take a sponge bath. It's cold, so it's not very warm to do that, and you have to take the time to melt snow to get the water to wash up. So we didn't do it very often. And actually, after a while, you sort of stop caring. After about 6 weeks on the ice sheet, another graduate student and a really good friend of mine started referring to me as a homeless boy's wet dream because my hair had gotten that greasy. Going to the bathroom was also a problem for me. We had this incinerator toilet that burns your waste. I usually have to get up in the middle of the night to go pee. My professor would tend to stay up later than the rest of us, and before he would come to bed, he would tend to use a toilet. So one night, I'm getting up, I'm getting all my cold weather gear on to go outside and go use a toilet, and I didn't realize the coils were still hot. So I went pee, and I got what I refer to as a shit steam bath. It was the most disgusting thing that I've ever experienced. And that smell just clung to your clothing. I was just absolutely horrible. That happened to me a few times until I finally got wine. And I started to pee in a soup can in the kitchen. And then I would dump that out the following morning. The one thing that you come to realize being in such a remote place and camping out like that is that you really can be happy and content without all your material possessions that you have in your daily life. Your dreams start to change as well, and your body clock is completely out of whack with the constant daylight. When I first arrived, I would go to bed around 10 o'clock at night, and by the time I left, I was going to bed at 6 in the morning. The other thing that happens is you're just in this really strange place where you're completely devoid of all sensory input, especially when you walk away from the campsite. I would sometimes take long walks to get away from the guys for a little while. And there's no sound out there. There's no smell. And if it's overcast, there's no distinguishing between the snow and the sky. It's quite eerie. And you're in this vast, large ice sheet, and yet you start to feel kind of claustrophobic. When it came time to leave the camp, we packed everything up, and we were sitting on our gear, eagerly awaiting for the aircraft and dreaming of our first hot shower in weeks. But the plane didn't come. The weather wasn't good enough for the plane to land. So it took about 3 days of packing and unpacking and packing again before the weather was finally good enough for the plane to come pick us up. When we got back to Ilalisat, summer had come, the snow had melted off, the muskox were grazing in the tundra, the boats in the harbor were now able to go fishing, and we were beset upon by hundreds of mosquitoes as soon as we got off the plane. And they are the size of flies, and they are voracious. They are so hungry. You know, in the early days when I had gone to Greenland, I didn't really think global warming was an issue. There still seemed to be lots of ice, and the data wasn't suggesting that anything was really changing up there, at least not too dramatically. It wasn't until the mid-2000s that I started to realize something funky is going on up in the Arctic. We kept having 1 year after another of record low sea ice conditions. Melt on Greenland was starting to expand to higher and higher elevations. I've come to learn that about 50 to 60% of the ice loss that we're seeing today in the Arctic is a direct result of increases of greenhouse gases that are warming our planet, and that with continued CO2 emissions, we will eventually see an Arctic Ocean that's ice-free in summer. And I do believe it's going to happen in my lifetime. This is a huge climate shift. It's not something that's happened for several thousands of years, if not hundreds of thousands of years. And it's hard to imagine that species such as the polar bears or seals or walruses can survive such rapid change. But, you know, I think there is hope in all of this. But it's hard to appreciate, I think, how dramatic these changes are unless you've been there, unless you've witnessed for yourself, you know, how quickly the ice is melting up there. I think the Arctic is one of the most beautiful places on the planet, and I would encourage everybody to see it while you still can. Thank you.
Julian Struve has a blog called Ice Edge 2012, where she documents an expedition to the Arctic Ocean. Simon Kiaga is a psychiatrist based at a research institute in Sweden, and Simon told two stories from his search for a possible link between genius and madness.
The first story starts at the psychiatric emergency ward in Stockholm. A few years back, I was a rather new resident physician in psychiatry, and I got to meet a patient that was referred to me from his general practitioner. Now, the question was manic depressive disorder, indication for inpatient treatment. In this referral, it was clear that this patient had been suffering recurrent episodes of mania and depression, and one reason was poor adherence to lithium. Now he had grandiose delusions, but he had comfort in his GP, who recommended him to seek emergency treatment and assessment. Now, I still remember how I took his folder and slowly started to walk towards the room where he was waiting. And I can tell you, if you haven't gone into an emergency room with a manic person waiting, usually you feel somewhat tense, because you often don't know how agitated or even violent that patient may be. So when I opened that door, it was with some concern. But then luckily, this man seemed calm. And moreover, he was about 8 years of age and rather short. He had a bushy white hair, a black hat, and an orange cardigan. And almost instantly, he looked me straight into the eyes. And he said with a very fast and loud voice, that I do not need to be here because I'm completely healthy. And also I'm very, very busy because I'm spending my days with the artistic and intellectual elite in Sweden. And my ability to attract young women is limitless. Well, I took a look at the man and I realized that the general practitioner was completely right, a clear case of grandiose delusions. So I offered him admission for overnight sleep and stabilization, and he did actually accept after some hesitation. But then the next morning at the round, there was a new nurse, and he told me that his wife was related to the patient. And it turned out that this patient was actually one of the most known visual artists in Sweden. And he regularly socialized with the artistic and intellectual elite in Sweden. And he was known for his many and current love affairs with young women. So I remember I sat at the table and sort of froze a bit and pondered, how would this affect my future career? But then luckily, when the head physician came, this man was still a bit agitated. And he actually thanked me, saying that he had not slept so well for ages. So we parted as friends, and I sort of breathed a sigh of relief and also realized that this had been my first contact with one of the oldest myths in Western society, the idea of genius springing from a close association to madness. Because this is really one of the oldest beliefs that we have, reiterated in literature and music and film. And we all know of these people, such as Van Gogh and Nash and Beethoven, who seem to stress that the line between genius and madness is so very, very thin. Or at least we're all tempted to believe that it is. In fact, there are many who oppose the idea. For instance, the vocal psychologist Judith Schlesinger, who recently in her book The Insanity Hoax says that the mad genius is simply a cultural artifact. And there is in fact no reason to believe that exceptionally creative people are more likely to hold psychiatric disorders. She says that there was this opportunity to actually address this question. A few years back, when the American Institute of Mental Health launched a $22 million study, but they failed to look on statistics for professions. So going to my second story, it starts in an autumn evening in light rain at a small bar in Stockholm. Mikael Andén, an associate professor at Karolinska Institutet, he's sitting together with his friend, Professor Paul Lichtenstein. They decide to once and for all address this question of the mad genius. They just have this question, who should they convince to tackle this effort? A few days later, I'm sitting in Mikael's office, and I don't remember how he said it, just that I sort of jotted down from the whiteboard and that I had this feeling that I really want to do this. And we did have a scientific trump card, that which is needed except from curiosity in research, and that is data. Almost unlimited access to data. Because in Sweden we have extensive records on healthcare in the entire population. Now, only for researchers is this data made available after ethical approval and after data has been rendered anonymous. But we had the possibility to actually address this question, and this in a material that was about 100 times bigger than the study that Schlesinger mentioned. So a few weeks later, a couple of researchers gather. But the problem is, of course, how do we find these creative people? What is a creative profession? Now, it might seem obvious, but if you consider that all occupations, in fact, rely on creativity to some extent, as does life itself, it's a bit more tricky. Luckily for us, we realized that there are a number of definitions, and we ended up with a rather conservative one, using artists and scientists who are believed to rely on creativity at their core. Now, by combining different registries, we could identify more than 1 million patients who had received psychiatric treatment and then collect data on their occupations. Now, I still remember with excitement as we sat down with the answer in our hand. We six researchers had the answer to this, you know, several thousand-year-old question on the mad genius. Now, today, after our results have been published and have received worldwide attention from the States to Australia, Europe, Africa, and Asia, my firm belief is that there is an association between creativity and psychiatric disorder. But these findings are specific. We found that patients with bipolar disorder and relatives to patients with bipolar disorder and schizophrenia are more likely to hold creative professions. But it does not hold for all psychiatric disorders. So what is it that makes bipolar disorder and schizophrenia so special? Well, it might be two things. It's ambition and drive, often seen in bipolar disorder and historically demonstrated in leaders and entrepreneurs. And secondly, in schizophrenia, the possibility to think differently, to challenge the norms. Einstein and Watson, both having sons suffering schizophrenia, both making major breakthroughs in modern science. And I have changed. No longer do I see upon psychiatric disorders as something completely black, but rather that there might be something valuable in all this misery that we need to treasure. And maybe might this link between creativity and mental illness actually answer one of the major mysteries in humanity: why we humans suffer mental illness at all. Thank you.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
Today on Conversations, stories told on stage at the World Science Festival that was held in Brisbane. Priya Natarajan grew up in Delhi. She went to MIT in the United States, and today she's a professor of astronomy and physics at Yale University. At the moment, Priya is taking on two of the most truly awesome problems in cosmology: mapping the distribution of dark matter and tracing the growth history of black holes. And on stage that night, she talked about her first tentative steps as a girl towards mapping the stars.
I led a very, very uncharted life, following my passions and sort of going with the flow, very unstrategized. I grew up in an academic household, so there were lots of books and atlases around. And I looked through a microscope, I'd looked through a telescope when I was very young, and I really had my curiosity stoked and indulged by my parents. And very soon, this was the 1980s, I actually got my own personal computer. It was very unusual at the time. It was a Commodore 64. Those of you who are of my age will realize that was quite a treat for me. So I learned how to code, and I was itching to do something. Luckily for me, the Nehru Planetarium in Delhi had just acquired a new director, this wonderful woman who had just returned from Caltech after doing a PhD in astrophysics. So I went up to her and I said, well, you know, I have a computer, I have my own computer, and I can code. Can I do something? So she looked at me and, you know, she said, well, I'm not so sure. So I pestered. I was like hanging around. I was helping volunteer at the planetarium just so that I could get to do something, to get my first taste of research. Then she said, okay, fine. Why don't you map the sky above Delhi? Why don't you write a little program to map the sky above Delhi? I think she thought I'd never come back, right? It's a hard problem for a 15-year-old. And so she sent me off, and, you know, I slaved at it. I was totally absorbed, and I came back at the end of the summer, and I'd done it. So I showed up, and I said, hey, so I've charted the sky above Delhi. So she looked at me, and I think she was slightly impressed, maybe. I couldn't tell. Then she said, well, Priya, this is great, but what if you move to Brisbane or Boston? Wouldn't you want to know what the sky above there looks like? I said, I thought of that already. All you need to do is put the latitude and longitude of any place on Earth, and this program will show you the night sky. I really fell in love with the cosmos at that point. And then life took me to, you know, various countries. I left India when I was very young, and I found myself in 2002 as a young professor at Yale. I had just joined, and there was an amazing opportunity that came my way. There was a park, the Torres del Paine, a national park in Patagonia, that was looking for volunteers to chart uncharted bits of the terrestrial trails in the park. And this was a unique opportunity, and I jumped at it. But, you know, that was very unusual for me. And I was a hiker, and I liked the outdoors, but I was not the kind of person who would fly 12 hours or 13 hours to go all the way to go do a hike. I was the kind of person who would fly 12 hours to go see a painting, or to go hear a musician play, or to hear an opera. But hiking? Not quite. But, you know, that was an unusual time in my life, right? I had had a very brief traumatic marriage. I had just come out of it. It had been a short marriage and a very prolonged divorce. So an acrimonious one. And so, you know, I felt particularly adrift at that time. And also it was a time when I felt somewhat lonely and somewhat at home everywhere. I had transited through these various cultures. I'd gone from India to America, to the UK, and back to the US. And I felt very much sort of unrooted, sort of drifting. So this seemed like an amazing opportunity to be in the solitude, to be in this incredible park all by myself, confront myself, and cut out all the noise and the clutter, and to sort of conquer my fear of being alone, my fear of not fitting in, my fear of feeling at home and not at home, feeling at home everywhere because I was malleable and I adjusted to places, but also not feeling rooted at all. So, you know, I sort of felt like an insider and an outsider all the time. So I decided that this was the thing I had to do. And for once, I actually planned my trip. I bought a GPS and I said, great, you know, I'm going to chart this park. So I show up, and it's quite an arduous flight. You have to fly all the way down to the southern tip, to Punta Arenas. Then you take a van, you go out to the center of the park. They drop you for 5 days and four nights. They pick you up at an allocated time, and you're supposed to chart. So I show up, and then I take out my backpack, and I don't have my GPS. I left it on the flight. So, of course, I sobbed, and I was really freaked out. But then I sort of realized that you sob because there's someone to listen to you cry, and then you just have to get on with it. So I just got on with it. And the day, the first day, was terrifying. It was scary as heck. Because the Patagonian landscape, I was not climbing mountains, right? It was all pretty flat, and you know, it was all pretty sane in terms of risk. But what it was it was very, very windy. And you would see all these trees that were petrified by the wind. So these very otherworldly shapes. It all looked like it was not quite Mars because there are no trees on Mars, but you know, some kind of otherworldly landscape. I just sort of imagined it to be really eerie, right? And I plodded along. I made my drawings and I took photographs and I charted what I was doing. And of course, contrary to what everyone else thinks, right, there was nightfall. And the canopy of stars lit up. I was not scared. I felt extremely at home because I knew where I was. I knew how to locate myself. So it was the most incredible feeling to suddenly see the southern sky, which I was seeing for the first time, to see the Milky Way, to see all these constellations, to see the planets, see everything that I had been charting and making as a young kid. And I think I had the most incredible experience in this park. It was transformative for me. My own work, my day job, unsurprisingly, right, is mapping and understanding all the dark forces that shape the universe, dark matter, dark energy, and black holes. So if you find yourself going back to Patagonia, you might find yourself walking on these trails. Some of these trails that people like me helped chart and make. And like me, you might also realize that maps not only show you where to go and lead the way, but they also tell you where you've come from. Thank you very much.
The final guest of the night was John Hockenberry. John isn't a scientist, but he is an award-winning broadcaster and journalist in the US. He hosts a program on New York Public Radio, and he's also a disability rights advocate. John came charging out in his wheelchair and told a story about his childhood experiments in science and in radical politics.
As a journalist among all these scientists, I have a tremendous feeling of insignificance. And it's something that I felt back as a teenager in Syracuse, New York, when I was a seventh grader in 1968, it was the definition of insignificance. You weren't a part of the civil rights movement, but it was happening all around you. You saw the politics that was exploding around you in America, but you were just a seventh grader. Nobody wanted seventh graders at the demo. Nobody wanted seventh graders in the Black Panthers. Nobody wanted seventh graders in the Weather Underground. But I was very interested in science. And my mother, who came from a different generation, obviously, she was someone who was raised in an era of the Cold War. She was a liberal, but a very confused American liberal. For instance, African-American blacks, we called them then, should not be slaves. You know, she'd figured that much out. And that they shouldn't be segregated. But because she was, you know, raised a kind of snooty, white, upper crust, something or other in upstate New York, you know, she would say things like, well, blacks are dirty. And I would say, but Mom, how do you know? Well, you'll learn, John. And I would say, Mom, I just don't know how you know things like that. She knew a lot of stuff. For instance, that anything that could possibly happen in our family of five kids was likely to cause my father to lose his job. She was terrified of CIA agents and FBI agents and the police. And if I disobeyed a traffic signal on my bicycle, she was concerned. Oh, great. Do you have any idea what it's going to mean for your father to have his son arrested for jaywalking? Anyway, I was very interested in science. I wasn't going anywhere in science. And my best friend in junior high school was a black boy, Michael Mitchell. He and I were the absolute best friends. I was interested in biology and particle physics, and boy, did I have a smelly lab in my basement. And my mother was terrified by it, and indeed, she was very worried that, you know, I would bring things home from the junkyard, refrigerator compressors I used to bring home, and I'd take them apart and turn them into vacuum makers so I could produce these vacuum tubes and try to beam particles and create these atom smashers that in Scientific American had taught you how to make these things. A lot of things blew up in my basement. And of course, my mother would say, do you have any idea what it's going to mean for your father? You blow up our basement and, you know, we lose our house, you know. Michael, on the other hand, was very interested in radios and electronics, and he was a wizard in making radios. And I would teach him things about particle physics and biology. He didn't particularly want to have a terrarium full of frogs in his basement. I called them my subjects. He called them, they seem like prisoners to me. In your basement. I said, no, they're, you know, I'm working on them. I'm experimenting, behavioral tests and stuff. Anyway, he had a laboratory with soldering irons and fabulous glasses that he would use to change printed circuits. And Michael and I, being such good friends, we spent so much time together. We wanted to be able to communicate at all times. We wanted to be able to talk to each other at night, have our arguments about politics and some of the things that confused us. I mean, we were such good friends, and the issue of race just never came into our relationship. His friends, on the other hand, though, were very, like, concerned that he had a white friend and he wanted to be so smart in sciences, and he would get regularly confronted that, you know, maybe that wasn't the thing to do if you were going to be, you know, a full-blooded member of the oppressed race in America that was trying to find its freedom. We understood kind of where that sentiment was coming from, but it didn't make any sense to us. Whereas my white friends would have all these abstract reasons why there needed to be racism in America, because everyone is prejudiced. It's built into their brains. And maybe it is. I mean, I don't know. It just didn't seem that way with me and Michael. We were two science nerds having such a great time. And you could buy at that time in the 1960s these walkie-talkies. I mean, they don't really exist anymore now because, why do you need a walkie-talkie if you got a smartphone, right? And you could buy these units at Radio Shack. But they were 100 milliwatts. So, I mean, you get more than, you know, from here to the end of the room. You know, so we wanted to use our scientific expertise to boost the power of these walkie-talkies. When you took off the back of the walkie-talkies and looked at their circuitry, there was a big warning. The FCC approves this communication device under the condition that it be only 100 milliwatts and the antenna has to be 12 centimeters or something. To in any way violate this rule will produce serious consequences. You'll be violating paragraph C of federal law X150. That sounds really cool. Michael and I were like, this is an invitation in fact. I mean, we're seventh graders. We have no significance. We could actually get some significance this way. We put in a new amplifier that was 10 times the size. We thought 100 milliwatts, maybe we could make it 2 watts. You know, Michael and I said, no, it's 10 watts. 10 watts, we calculated, would actually give it a range across almost the entire city of Syracuse. That was awesome. We were making it happen, and sure enough, we tested it one night, and we had both of them up. We had them on the right frequency. You know, Michael, are you there? And it came in. So he lived, you know, 2 streets away. So now that we had this communications system, what would we do at night? What would we talk about? Well, we invented a kind of coded language. And our coded language came from the politics and the racial confusion and political confusion that was going on at the time. And I mentioned at the top the Great White Hope. But the Great White Hope actually reminds me of a play that was popular on Broadway right at this time when I was a teenager. It's like James Earl Jones playing a boxer, Jack Johnson. And the Great White Hope referred to how the boxing world wanted a white boxer to take down Jack Johnson because he was the heavyweight champion. And the co-star was Jane Alexander. And it was so controversial, this play. They had a love affair on stage at the same time, a white actress and a black actor on stage. And there was lots of talk about it, and some of it got into our language. So when we would talk to each other at night, I would be the Great White Hope. Great White Hope, calling Great Black Hope. Come in, please, Great Black Hope. Yep, Great Black Hope here. Hello, Great White Hope. And what did we talk about? Well, we talked about, like, pretending that we were members of the Black Panthers. We talked about the armed struggle against the American government. How much explosive do you think we could get, you know, together? Thank you very much, Great Black Hope. Great White Hope, signing out. And we did this for night after night after night after night. We never noticed a van, an unmarked van, start driving down Crawford Avenue. And it had some strange equipment on it, but we were just so thrilled with our new communication devices that we paid no attention whatsoever at all. Well, one afternoon after school, I was at home, sitting in the kitchen. My mother was 2 martinis and a half or something like that. It was bad timing for women in America in the 1960s because they went through the 50s thinking that, like, all you had to do was just marry somebody. And then in the 60s, it was like, that idea sucked. And so she was, like, stuck. I mean, you know, it was good that she drank, actually, I think, in some ways. I give her that. But this only enhanced her sense of threat and menace. And so when 2 uniformed federal officers knocked at the door and said, is this the Hockenberry residence? My mother, the blood draining from her face, nobody even said anything. And let me tell you something about my mother. If you meet her, one of the first things you learn is that her most scary day was February 28th, 1976. Worst day of my life, sweetheart. And of course, that's the day that I got into a car accident and my vehicle rolled down a 200-foot embankment and burst into flames, and I never walked again. And she got this phone call that said that her oldest son was in a car accident and that, in fact, he might not make it, and that she better come to Pennsylvania immediately and see what was going on there. Now, yeah, I can totally understand how that might be a really, really miserable phone call to receive. But it was maybe my worst day, not her worst day. She can't have my worst day. That's not fair. And I, in fact, know what her worst day was. And her worst day was this day when the federal agents came to the door and said, have you ever heard of the Black Panther Party, ma'am? My mother was practically a seizure case at that point. I mean, she... I don't know anything
about it. I'm out in the kitchen eating Rice Krispies, you know, going, oh my God. Oh my God. They left. Certainly, my mother was not the person they expected to see. I mean, they expected to see someone with an AK-47, I think. And my mother was certainly not. So they went away. They said, we'll be back, you know. And so my mother comes staggering out into the kitchen. And she looks at me and she says, are you a member of the Black Panthers? And I had two thoughts. Thought number one was, this is my opportunity to claim some significance here. I could wipe out all of that insignificance right now if I answered yes to that question. And the second thing was, oh my God, I know what she's going to say. And sure enough, what's it going to look like for your father to have a son who's a member of the Black Panthers? He's going to lose his job and we're going to be living in the street. And I said, Mom, I'm not a member of the Black Panthers. So, well, then where the hell did they get this idea? And I took her down to my lab and showed her the walkie-talkie. Well, what have you been talking about? Just stuff, you know, code words, stuff like that. That I have a laboratory in the basement and, you know, I'm holding some prisoners down here. And I mean, I can't imagine they would take any seriously at all. Well, my mother staggers back into her bedroom, closes the door, and I got on the phone to Michael. I say, Michael, we are in so much trouble right now. I am telling you, we are in so much trouble. He'd already heard from the agents, and he said, they'll be back. They're going to take the equipment. It's okay, but we definitely are in trouble for modifying the radios, that's for sure. Sure enough, the agents came back to the house the next day and confronted me. And I said, officers, I'm really sorry we modified the radios and were disrupting communications. And they said, we just have to ask this, son, are you a member of the Black Panthers? And once again, I had that thought. If I just say yes, I'm a part of the revolution. But I said, no, I'm not. I'm just a nerdy science-y guy with a lab. Are you holding prisoners in the basement? French prisoners. And I said, no, they're frogs. They're just some frogs in a tank. They went away. You know, years went by. I had my accident. I became a journalist. I was no good at science, but I understood enough about science from all those years of fiddling with things and reading about things to be able to do a lot of great science journalism. And indeed, I became a member of the disability community, as Richard pointed out, America's hippest minority. And indeed, we experience a lot of the same sort of intolerance and insensitivity that all of the minorities in America have experienced. And indeed, you know, the way we deal with it in America is just make sure you've got somebody from every race and pissed off community in the picture, okay? We call that diversity in America. That's going to work. If you just put everyone in the picture, they'll feel better, and it'll just kind of work out that everyone loves everyone else, you know. I got a call in 2009 after a very, you know, distinguished career as a journalist. Barack Obama was arrested, or was arrested, was elected president. See, Donald Trump is already having an effect on you. He was elected president. It was an amazing time. My dear friend, Paul Mitchell, who was a member of the disability community, called me up and said, we got to get you into this administration somehow. And I said, well, what are you talking about? He said, well, yeah, I've got the perfect place for you. You can be on the White House Fellows Commission. It's a great commission. You meet once a year. It's a really amazing thing. You get in touch with all kinds of fantastic people. They'll send you an application, and then there'll just be this little background check, and that's it. That's all. It's going to happen. And the application went great. You know, I was kind of the best known person, except for a couple of people, on the prospective commissioners. And so nobody expected there to be any kind of issue with my confirmation. But finally, I got some calls from two people who were a part of the whole FBI investigation into the background of John Huckenberry. And they asked me a lot of questions about what had gone on earlier in my life. They asked me questions about all sorts of stuff, and I had to explain all this stuff. And it took a while, and I, you know, sometimes I'm like, oh, God, there's that. Oh, yeah, I did, yeah. Yeah, I did that, yeah. But it wasn't so big. I mean, is there anything else you want to ask? Well, there's not really anything else, but I mean, we're looking at this file here. I have to ask you, have you ever been a member of the Black Panther? And I had that thought one more time. If I just said yes, I could certainly prove my credentials with the revolution. Instead, I'm a proud member of the White House Fellows Commission and serve today in that capacity and have never been a member of the Black Panthers Party. Thank you very much. Thank you, Brisbane.
John Huckenberry hosts The Takeaway on WNYC in New York City. Our thanks to the World Science Festival and to our distinguished storytellers, Ian Fraser, Julianne Struver, Simon Kiaga, Priya Natarajan, and John Huckenberry.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
Our website is abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.